Chapter 11. The Sunningdale Mystery. Do you know where we're going to lunch today, Tuppence? Mrs. Beresford considered the question. The Ritz? She suggested hopefully. Think again. That nice little place in Soho? No. Tommy's tone was full of importance. An ABC shop. This one, in fact. He drew her deftly inside an establishment of the kind indicated, and steered her to a corner marble-topped table. Excellent, said Tommy with satisfaction, as he seated himself. Couldn't be better. Why has this craze for the simple life come upon you? Demanded Tuppence. You see, Watson, but you do not observe. I wonder now whether one of these haughty damsels would condescend to notice us. Splendid. She drifts this way. It is true that she appears to be thinking of something else, but doubtless her subconscious mind is functioning busily with such matters as ham and eggs and pots of tea. Chop and fried potatoes, please, miss, and a large coffee, a roll and butter, and a plate of tongue for the lady. The waitress repeated the order in a scornful tone, but Tuppence leant forward suddenly and interrupted her. No, not a chop and fried potatoes. This gentleman will have a cheesecake and a glass of milk. A cheesecake and a milk, said the waitress with even deeper scorn, if that were possible. Still thinking of something else, she drifted away again. Well, that was uncalled for, said Tommy coldly. But I'm right, aren't I? You are the old man in the corner. Where's your piece of string? Tommy drew a long, twisted mesh of string from his pocket and proceeded to tie a couple of knots in it. Complete to the smallest detail, he murmured. You made a small mistake in ordering your meal, though. Women are so literal-minded, said Tommy. If there's one thing I hate, it's milk to drink, and cheesecakes are always so yellow and bilious-looking. Be an artist, said Tuppence. Watch me attack my cold tongue. Jolly good stuff, cold tongue. Now then, I'm all ready to be Miss Polly Burton. Tie a large knot and begin. First of all, said Tommy, speaking in a strictly unofficial capacity, let me point out this. Business is not too brisk lately. If business does not come to us, we must go to business. Apply our minds to one of the great public mysteries of the moment. Which brings me to the point. The Sunningdale Mystery. Ah, said Tuppence, with deep interest. The Sunningdale Mystery. Tommy drew a crumpled piece of newspaper from his pocket and laid it on the table. That is the latest portrait of Captain Cecil, as it appeared in the Daily Leader. Just so, said Tuppence. I wonder someone doesn't sue these newspapers sometimes. You can see it's a man, and that's all. When I said the Sunningdale Mystery, I should have said the so-called Sunningdale Mystery, went on Tommy rapidly. A mystery to the police, perhaps, but not to an intelligent mind. Tie another knot, said Tuppence. I don't know how much of the case you remember, continued Tommy quietly. All of it, said Tuppence, but don't let me cramp your style. It was just over 3 weeks ago, said Tommy, that the gruesome discovery was made on the famous golf links. Two members of the club, who were enjoying an early round, were horrified to find the body of a man lying face downwards on the seventh tee. Even before they turned him over, they had guessed him to be Captain Cecil, a well-known figure on the links, and who always wore a golf coat of a peculiarly bright blue colour. Captain Cecil was often seen out on the links early in the morning, practising, and it was thought at first that he had been suddenly overcome by some form of heart disease. But examination by a doctor revealed the sinister fact that he had been murdered, stabbed to the heart, with a significant object, a woman's hatpin. He was also found to have been dead at least 12 hours. That put an entirely different complexion on the matter, and very soon some interesting facts came to light. Practically the last person to see Captain Cecil alive was his friend and partner, Mr. Hollaby, of the Porcupine Assurance Company, and he told his story as follows. Cecil and he had played a round earlier in the day. After tea, the other suggested they should play a few more holes before it got too dark to see. Hollaby assented. Cecil seemed in good spirits and was in excellent form. There is a public footpath that crosses the links, and just as they were playing up to the sixth green, Hollaby noticed a woman coming along it. She was very tall and dressed in brown, but he did not observe her particularly, and Cecil, he thought, did not notice her at all. The footpath in question crossed in front of the seventh tee, continued Tommy. The woman had passed along this and was standing at the farther side as though waiting. Captain Cecil was the first to reach the tee, as Mr. Holloby was replacing the pin in the hole. As the latter came towards the tee, he was astonished to see Cecil and the woman talking together. As he came nearer, they both turned abruptly, Cecil calling over his shoulder, "Shan't be a minute." The two of them walked off side by side, still deep in earnest conversation. The footpath there leaves the course, and passing between the two narrow hedges of neighbouring gardens, comes out on the road to Windlesham. Captain Cecil was as good as his word. He reappeared within a minute or two, much to Holloby's satisfaction, as two other players were coming up behind them, and the light was failing rapidly. They drove off, and at once Holloby noticed that something had occurred to upset his companion. Not only did he foozle his drive badly, but his face was worried, and his forehead creased in a big frown. He hardly answered his companion's remarks, and his golf was atrocious. Evidently, something had occurred to put him completely off his game. They played that hole and the eighth, and then Captain Cecil declared abruptly that the light was too bad and that he was off home. Just at that point, there is another of those narrow slips leading to the Windlesham Road, and Captain Cecil departed that way, which was a short cut to his home, a small bungalow on the road in question. The other two players came up, a Major Barnard and Mr. Leckie, and to them Holloby mentioned Captain Cecil's sudden change of manner. They also had seen him speaking to the woman in brown, but had not been near enough to see her face. All three men wondered what she could have said to upset their friend to that extent. They returned to the clubhouse together, and as far as was known at the time, were the last people to see Captain Cecil alive. The day was a Wednesday, and on Wednesday cheap tickets to London are issued. The man and wife, who ran Captain Cecil's small bungalow, were up in town, according to custom, and did not return until the late train. They entered the bungalow as usual, and supposed their master to be in his room asleep. Mrs. Cecil, his wife, was away on a visit. The murder of the captain was a 9 days' wonder. Nobody could suggest a motive for it. The identity of the tall woman in brown was eagerly discussed, but without result. The police were, as usual, blamed for their supineness, most unjustly, as time was to show. For a week later, a girl called Doris Evans was arrested and charged with the murder of Captain Anthony Cecil. The police had had little to work upon. A strand of fair hair caught in the dead man's fingers, and a few threads of flame-coloured wool caught on one of the buttons of his blue coat. Diligent inquiries at the railway station and elsewhere had elicited the following facts. A young girl, dressed in a flame-coloured coat and skirt, had arrived by train that evening, about 7 o'clock, and had asked the way to Captain Cecil's house. The same girl had reappeared again at the station 2 hours later. Her hat was awry and her hair tousled, and she seemed in a state of great agitation. She inquired about the trains back to town and was continually looking over her shoulder, as though afraid of something. Our police force is in many ways very wonderful. With this slender evidence to go upon, they managed to track down the girl and identify her as one Doris Evans. She was charged with murder and cautioned that anything she might say would be used against her. But she nevertheless persisted in making a statement. And this statement she repeated again in detail, without any subsequent variation, at the subsequent proceedings. Her story was this. She was a typist by profession, and had made friends one evening in a cinema with a well-dressed man who declared he had taken a fancy to her. His name, he told her, was Anthony, and he suggested that she should come down to his bungalow at Sunningdale. She had no idea then, or at any other time, that he had a wife. It was arranged between them that she should come down on the following Wednesday, the day, you will remember, when the servants would be absent and his wife away from home. In the end, he told her his full name was Anthony Cecil, and gave her the name of his house. She duly arrived at the bungalow on the evening in question, and was greeted by Cecil, who had just come in from the links. Though he professed himself delighted to see her, the girl declared that from the first his manner was strange and different. A half-acknowledged fear sprang up in her, and she wished fervently that she had not come. After a simple meal, which was all ready and prepared, Cecil suggested going out for a stroll. The girl consenting, He took her out of the house, down the road, and along the slip onto the golf course. And then suddenly, just as they were crossing the seventh tee, he seemed to go completely mad. Drawing a revolver from his pocket, he brandished it in the air, declaring that he had come to the end of his tether. "Everything must go. I'm ruined. Done for. And you shall go with me. I shall shoot you first, then myself. They will find our bodies here in the morning, side by side, together in death." And so on. A lot more. He had hold of Doris Evans by the arm, and she, realizing she had to do with a madman, made frantic efforts to free herself, or failing that, to get the revolver away from him. They struggled together, and in that struggle he must have torn out a piece of her hair and got the wool of her coat entangled on a button. Finally, with a desperate effort, she freed herself and ran for her life across the golf links, expecting every minute to be shot down with a revolver bullet. She fell twice, tripping over the heather, but eventually regained the road to the station and realized that she was not being pursued. That is the story that Doris Evans tells, and from which she has never varied. She strenuously denies that she ever struck at him with a hatpin in self-defense, a natural enough thing to do under the circumstances, and one which may well be the truth. In support of her story, a revolver has been found in the furze bushes near where the body was lying. It had not been fired. Doris Evans has been sent for trial, but the mystery still remains a mystery. If her story is to be believed, who was it who stabbed Captain Cecil? The other woman? The tall woman in brown whose appearance so upset him? So far, no one has explained her connection with the case. She appears out of space suddenly on the footpath across the links. She disappears along the slip, and no one ever hears of her again. Who was she? A local resident? A visitor from London? If so, did she come by car or by train? There is nothing remarkable about her except her height. No one seems to be able to describe her appearance. She could not have been Doris Evans, for Doris Evans is small and fair, and moreover, was only just then arriving at the station. "The wife?" suggested Tuppence. "What about the wife? A very natural suggestion. But Mrs. Cecil is also a small woman, and besides, Mr. Hollaby knows her well by sight, and there seems no doubt that she was really away from home." One further development has come to light. The Porcupine Assurance Company is in liquidation. The accounts reveal the most daring misappropriation of funds. The reasons for Captain Cecil's wild words to Doris Evans are now quite apparent. For some years past, he must have been systematically embezzling money. Neither Mr. Hollaby nor his son had any idea of what was going on. They are practically ruined. The case stands like this. Captain Cecil was on the verge of discovery and ruin. Suicide would be a natural solution, but the nature of the wound rules that theory out. Who killed him? Was it Doris Evans? Was it the mystery woman in brown? Tommy paused, took a sip of milk, made a wry face, and bit cautiously at the cheesecake. "Of course," murmured Tommy, "I saw at once where the hitch in this particular case lay, and just where the police were going astray." "Yes," said Tuppence eagerly. Tommy shook his head sadly. "I wish I did, Tuppence. It's dead easy being the old man in the corner up to a certain point, but the solution beats me. Who did murder the beggar? I don't know." He took some more newspaper cuttings out of his pocket. "Further exhibits. Mr. Hollaby, his son, Mrs. Cecil, Doris Evans." Tuppence pounced on the last and looked at it for some time. "Well, she didn't murder him anyway," she remarked at last. "Not with a hatpin." "Why this certainty?" "A Lady Molly touch. She's got bobbed hair. Only one woman in 20 uses hatpins nowadays anyway, long hair or short. Hats fit tight and pull on. There's no need for such a thing." "Still, she might have had one by her." "My dear boy, we don't keep them as heirlooms. What on earth should she have brought a hatpin down to Sunningdale for?" "Well, then it must have been the other woman, the woman in brown." "I wish she hadn't been tall. Then she could have been the wife. I always suspect wives who were away at the time, so couldn't have had anything to do with it. If she found her husband carrying on with that girl, it would be quite natural for her to go for him with a hatpin." "I shall have to be careful, I see," remarked Tommy. But Tuppence was deep in thought and refused to be drawn. "What were the Cecils like?" she asked suddenly. "What sort of things did people say about them?" "Well, as far as I can make out, they were very popular. He and his wife were supposed to be devoted to one another. That's what makes the business of the girl so odd. It's the last thing you'd have expected of a man like Cecil. He was an ex-soldier, you know. Came into a good bit of money, retired, and went into this insurance business. The last man in the world, apparently, whom you would have suspected of being a crook. Is it absolutely certain that he was the crook? Couldn't it have been the other two who took the money? But the Hollabies? Well, they say they're ruined. Oh, they say. Perhaps they've got it all in a bank under another name. I put it foolishly, I dare say, but you know what I mean. Suppose they'd been speculating with the money for some time, unbeknownst to Cecil, and lost it all. Might be jolly convenient for them that Cecil died when he did." Tommy tapped the photograph of Mr. Hollaby Sr. with his fingernail. "So you're accusing this respectable gentleman of murdering his friend and partner? You forget that he parted from Cecil on the links in full view of Barnard and Leckie, and spent the evening in the Dormy House. Besides, there's the hatpin." "Oh, bother the hatpin," said Tuppence impatiently. "That hatpin, you think, points to the crime having been committed by a woman." "Well, naturally. Don't you agree?" "No. Men are notoriously old-fashioned. It takes them ages to rid themselves of preconceived ideas. They associate hatpins and hairpins with the female sex and call them women's weapons. They may have been in the past, but they're both rather out of date now. Why, I haven't had a hatpin or a hairpin for the last 4 years. Well, then you think that it was a man killed Cecil. The hatpin was used to make it seem a woman's crime." "There's something in what you say, Tuppence," said Tommy slowly. "It's extraordinary how things seem to straighten themselves out when you talk a thing over." Tuppence nodded. "Everything must be logical, if you look at it the right way. And remember what Marriott once said about the amateur point of view, that it had the intimacy. We know something about people like Captain Cecil and his wife. We know what they're likely to do, and what they're not likely to do. And we've each got our special knowledge." Tommy smiled. "You mean," he said, "that you are an authority on what people with bobbed and shingled heads are likely to have in their possession, and that you have an intimate acquaintance with what wives are likely to feel and do? Or something of the sort? And what about me? What is my special knowledge? Do husbands pick up girls, etc.?" "No," said Tuppence gravely. "You know the course. You've been on it. Not as a detective searching for clues, but as a golfer. You know about golf, and what's likely to put a man off his game." "It must have been something pretty serious to put Cecil off his game. His handicap's 2, and from the 7th tee on he played like a child, so they say." "Who say?" "Barnard and Leckie. They were playing just behind him, you remember." "That was after he met the woman, the tall woman in brown. They saw him speaking to her, didn't they?"
"Yes. At least—"
Tommy broke off. Tuppence looked up at him and was puzzled. He was staring at the piece of string in his fingers, but staring with the eyes of one who sees something very different. "Tommy, what is it?"
"Be quiet, Tuppence.
I'm playing the 6th hole at Sunningdale. Cecil and old Hollaby are holing out on the 6th green ahead of me. It's getting dusk, but I can see that bright blue coat of Cecil's clearly enough. And on the footpath to the left of me, there's a woman coming along. She hasn't crossed from the ladies' course. That's on the right. I should have seen her if she'd done so. And it's odd I didn't see her on the footpath before. From the 5th tee, for instance." He paused. "You said just now I knew the course, Tuppence. Just behind the 6th tee, there's a little hut or shelter made of turf. Anyone could wait in there until the right moment came. They could change their appearance there. I mean, tell me, Tuppence, this is where your special knowledge comes in again. Would it be very difficult for a man to look like a woman and then change back to being a man again? Could he wear a skirt over +4s, for instance?" "Well, certainly he could. The woman would look a bit bulky, that would be all. A longish brown skirt, say, a brown sweater of the kind both men and women wear, and a woman's felt hat with a bunch of side curls attached to each side. That would be all that was needed. I'm speaking, of course, of what would pass at a distance, which I take to be what you're driving at. Switch off the skirt,
Take off the hat and curls, put on a man's cap, which you can carry rolled up in your hand, and there you'd be, back as a man again. And the time required for the transformation? From woman to man? 1.5 minutes at the outside, probably a good deal less. The other way about would take longer. You'd have to arrange the hat and curls a bit, and the skirt would stick, getting it on over +4s. Well, that doesn't worry me. It's the time for the first that matters. As I tell you, I'm playing the 6th hole. The woman in brown has reached the 7th tee now. She crosses it and waits. Cecil, in his blue coat, goes towards her. They stand together 1 minute, and then they follow the path round the trees out of sight. Hollaby is on the tee alone. 2 or 3 minutes pass. I'm on the green now. The man in the blue coat comes back and drives off, foozling badly. The light's getting worse. I and my partner go on. Ahead of us are those two. Cecil slicing and topping and doing everything he shouldn't do. At the 8th green, I see him stride off and vanish down the slip. What happened to him to make him play like a different man? The woman in brown. Or the man, if you think it was a man. Exactly. And where they were standing. Out of sight, remember, of those coming after them, there's a deep tangle of furze bushes. You could thrust a body in there, and it would be pretty certain to lie hidden until the morning. Tommy, you think it was then, but someone would have heard. Heard what? The doctors agreed death must have been instantaneous. I've seen men killed instantaneously in the war. They don't cry out as a rule, just a gurgle or a moan, perhaps just a sigh or a funny little cough. Cecil comes towards the 7th tee, and the woman comes forward and speaks to him. He recognizes her, perhaps as a man he knows masquerading. Curious to learn the why and wherefore, he allows himself to be drawn along the footpath out of sight. One stab with the deadly hatpin as they walk along, Cecil falls, dead. The other man drags his body into the furze bushes, strips off the blue coat, then sheds his own skirt and the hat and curls. He puts on Cecil's well-known blue coat and cap and strides back to the tee. 3 minutes would do it. The others behind can't see his face, only the peculiar blue coat they know so well. They never doubt that it's Cecil, but he doesn't play Cecil's brand of golf. They all say he played like a different man. Of course he did. He was a different man. But point 2, his action in bringing the girl down there was the action of a different man. It wasn't Cecil who met Doris Evans at a cinema and induced her to come down to Sunningdale. It was a man calling himself Cecil. Remember, Doris Evans wasn't arrested until a fortnight after the time. She never saw the body. If she had, she might have bewildered everyone by declaring that it wasn't the man who took her out on the golf links that night and spoke so wildly of suicide. It was a carefully laid plot. The girl invited down for Wednesday when Cecil's house would be empty, then the hatpin, which pointed to its being a woman's doing. The murderer meets the girl, takes her into the bungalow and gives her supper, then takes her out on the links, and when he gets to the scene of the crime, brandishes his revolver and scares the life out of her. Once she has taken to her heels, all he has to do is pull out the body and leave it lying on the tee. The revolver he chucks into the bushes. Then he makes a neat parcel of the skirt and, now I admit I'm guessing, in all probability, walks to Woking, which is only about 6 or 7 miles away, and goes back to town from there. Wait a minute, said Tuppence. There's one thing you haven't explained. What about Hollaby? Hollaby? Yes. I admit that the people behind couldn't have seen whether it was really Cecil or not, but you can't tell me that the man who was playing with him was so hypnotized by the blue coat that he never looked at his face. My dear old thing, said Tommy, that's just the point. Hollaby knew all right. You see, I'm adopting your theory, that Hollaby and his son were the real embezzlers. The murderer's got to be a man who knew Cecil pretty well, knew, for instance, about the servants being always out on a Wednesday, and that his wife was away, and also someone who was able to get an impression of Cecil's latchkey. I think Hollaby Jr. would fulfill all those requirements. He's about the same age and height as Cecil, and they were both clean-shaven men. Doris Evans probably saw several photographs of the murdered man reproduced in the papers. But as you yourself observed, one can just see that it's a man, and that's about all. Didn't she ever see Hollaby in court? The son never appeared in the case at all. Why should he? He had no evidence to give. It was old Hollaby, with his irreproachable alibi, who stood in the limelight throughout. Nobody has ever bothered to inquire what his son was doing that particular evening. It all fits in, admitted Tuppence. She paused a minute, and then asked, Are you going to tell all this to the police?
I don't know if they'd listen.
They listen all right, said an unexpected voice behind him.
Tommy swung round to confront Inspector Marriott. The inspector was sitting at the next table. In front of him was a poached egg.
Often drop in here to lunch, said Inspector Marriott. As I was saying, we'll listen all right. In fact, I've been listening. I don't mind telling you that we've not been quite satisfied all along over those porcupine figures. You see, we've had our suspicions of those Hollabies, but nothing to go upon. Too sharp for us. Then this murder came, and that seemed to upset all our ideas. But thanks to you and the lady, sir, we'll confront young Hollaby with Doris Evans and see if she recognizes him. I rather fancy she will. That's a very ingenious idea of yours about the blue coat. I'll see that Blunt's brilliant detectives get the credit for it.
You are a nice man, Inspector Marriott, said Tuppence gratefully.
We think a lot of you two at the Yard, replied that stolid gentleman. You'd be surprised.
If I may ask you, sir, what's the meaning of that piece of string?
Oh, nothing, said Tommy, stuffing it into his pocket.
A bad habit of mine. As to the cheesecake and the milk, I'm on a diet. Nervous dyspepsia. Busy men are always martyrs to it.
Ah, said the detective. I thought perhaps you'd been reading.
It's of no consequence.
But the inspector's eyes twinkled.
Chapter 12 The House of Lurking Death.
What? Began Tuppence, and then stopped. She had just entered the private office of Mr. Blunt from the adjoining one marked Clerk's, and was surprised to behold her lord and master with his eye riveted to the private peephole into the outer office.
Shh, said Tommy warningly. Didn't you hear the buzzer? It's a girl, a rather nice girl. In fact, she looks to me a frightfully nice girl. Albert is telling her all that tosh about my being engaged with Scotland Yard.
Let me see, demanded Tuppence.
Somewhat unwillingly, Tommy moved aside. Tuppence, in her turn, glued her eye to the peephole.
She's not bad, admitted Tuppence, and her clothes are simply the latest shout.
She's perfectly lovely, said Tommy. She's like those girls Mason writes about, you know, frightfully sympathetic and beautiful and distinctly intelligent without being too saucy. I think, yes, I certainly think I shall be the great Hanno this morning.
Said Tuppence. If there's one detective out of all the others whom you are most unlike, I should say it was Hanno.
Can you do the lightning changes of personality? Can you be the great comedian, the little gutter boy, the serious and sympathetic friend, all in 5 minutes?
I know this, said Tommy, rapping sharply on the desk. I am the captain of the ship, and don't you forget it, Tuppence. I'm going to have her in.
He pressed the buzzer on his desk. Albert appeared, ushering in the client. The girl stopped in the doorway, as though undecided. Tommy came forward.
Come in, mademoiselle, he said kindly, and seat yourself here.
Tuppence choked audibly, and Tommy turned upon her with a swift change of manner. His tone was menacing.
You spoke, Miss Robinson?
Ah, no, I thought not.
He turned back to the girl.
We will not be serious or formal, he said. You will just tell me about it, and then we will discuss the best way to help you.
You are very kind, said the girl. Excuse me, but are you a foreigner?
A fresh choke from Tuppence. Tommy glared in her direction out of the corner of his eye.
Not exactly, he said with difficulty, but of late years I have worked a good deal abroad. My methods are the methods of the Sûreté.
Oh, the girl seemed impressed. She was, as Tommy had indicated, a very charming girl. Young and slim, with a trace of golden hair peeping out from under her little brown felt hat, and big, serious eyes. She was nervous, as could be plainly seen. Her little hands were twisting themselves together, and she kept clasping and unclasping the catch of her lacquered handbag.
First of all, Mr. Blunt, I must tell you that my name is Lois Hargreaves. I live in a great rambling old-fashioned house called Thurnley Grange. It is in the heart of the country. There is the village of Thurnley nearby, but it is very small and insignificant. There is plenty of hunting in winter, and we get tennis in summer, and I have never felt lonely there. Indeed, I much prefer country to town life. I tell you this so that you may realize that in a country village like ours, everything that happens is of supreme importance. About a week ago, I got a box of chocolates sent through the post. There was nothing inside to indicate who they came from. Now, I myself am not particularly fond of chocolates, but the others in the house are, and the box was passed round. As a result, everyone who had eaten any chocolates was taken ill. We sent for the doctor, and after various inquiries as to what other things had been eaten, he took the remains of the chocolates away with him and had them analysed. Mr. Blunt, those chocolates contained arsenic. Not enough to kill anyone, but enough to make anyone quite ill.
Extraordinary, commented Tommy.
Dr. Burton was very excited over the matter. It seems that this was the third occurrence of the kind in the neighbourhood. In each case, a big house was selected, and the inmates were taken ill after eating the mysterious chocolates. It looked as though some local person of weak intellect was playing a particularly fiendish practical joke.
Quite so, Miss Hargreaves.
Dr. Burton put it down to socialist agitation, rather absurdly, I thought. But there are one or two malcontents in Thurley Village, and it seemed possible that they might have had something to do with it. Dr. Burton was very keen that I should put the whole thing in the hands of the police.
A very natural suggestion, said Tommy. But you have not done so, I gather, Miss Hargreaves.
No, admitted the girl. I hate the fuss and the publicity that would ensue. And you see, I know our local inspector. I can never imagine him finding out anything. I've often seen your advertisements, and I told Dr. Burton that it would be much better to call in a private detective.
I see.
You say a great deal about discretion in your advertisement. I take that to mean that you would not make anything public without my consent.
Tommy looked at her curiously, but it was Tuppence who spoke.
I think, she said quietly, that it would be as well if Miss Hargreaves told us everything.
She laid special stress upon the last word, and Lois Hargreaves flushed nervously.
Yes, said Tommy quickly. Miss Robinson is right. You must tell us everything.
You will not, she hesitated.
Everything you say is understood to be strictly in confidence.
Thank you. I know that I ought to have been quite frank with you. I have a reason for not going to the police. Mr. Blunt, that box of chocolates was sent by someone in our house.
How do you know that, mademoiselle?
It's very simple. I've got a habit of drawing a little silly thing, three fish intertwined, whenever I have a pencil in my hand. A parcel of silk stockings arrived from a certain shop in London not long ago, and we were at the breakfast table. I'd just been marking something in the newspaper, and without thinking I began to draw my silly little fish on the label of the parcel before cutting the string and opening it. I thought no more about the matter, but when I was examining the piece of brown paper in which the chocolates had been sent, I caught sight of the corner of the original label, most of which had been torn off. My silly little drawing was on it.
Tommy drew his chair forward.
This is very serious. It creates, as you say, a very strong presumption that the sender of the chocolates is a member of your household. But you will forgive me if I say that I still do not see why that fact should render you indisposed to call in the police.
Lois Hargreaves looked him squarely in the face.
I will tell you, Mr. Blunt. I may want the whole thing hushed up.
Tommy retired gracefully from the position.
In that case, he murmured, we know where we are. I see, Miss Hargreaves, that you are not disposed to tell me who it is you suspect.
I suspect no one. But there are possibilities.
Quite so. Now, will you describe the household to me in detail?
The servants, with the exception of the parlourmaid, are all old ones who've been with us many years. I must explain to you, Mr. Blunt, that I was brought up by my aunt, Lady Radcliffe, who was extremely wealthy. Her husband made a big fortune and was knighted.
It was he who bought Thurnley Grange, but he died 2 years after going there, and it was then that Lady Radcliffe sent for me to come and make my home with her. I was her only living relation. The other inmate of the house was Dennis Radcliffe, her husband's nephew. I've always called him cousin, but of course he is really nothing of the kind. Aunt Lucy always said openly that she intended to leave her money, with the exception of a small provision for me, to Dennis. It was Radcliffe money, she said, and it ought to go to a Radcliffe. However, when Dennis was 22, she quarrelled violently with him over some debts that he had run up, I think. When she died a year later, I was astonished to find that she had made a will leaving all her money to me. It was, I know, a great blow to Dennis, and I felt very badly about it. I would have given him the money if he would have taken it, but it seems that kind of thing can't be done. However, as soon as I was 21, I made a will leaving it all to him. That's the least I can do. So, if I'm run over by a motor, Dennis will come into his own.
Exactly, said Tommy. And when were you 21, if I may ask the question?
Just 3 weeks ago.
Ah, said Tommy. Now, will you give me fuller particulars of the members of your household at this minute?
Servants or others?
Both.
The servants, as I say, have been with us some time. There is old Mrs. Holloway, the cook, and her niece Rose, the kitchen maid. Then there are two elderly housemaids, and Hannah, who was my aunt's maid, and who has always been devoted to me. The parlourmaid is called Esther Quant, and seems a very nice, quiet girl. As for ourselves, there is Miss Logan, who is Aunt Lucy's companion, and who runs the house for me. And Captain Radcliffe, Dennis, you know, whom I told you about. And there is a girl called Mary Chilcott, an old school friend of mine who is staying with us. Tommy thought for a moment.
That all seems fairly clear and straightforward, Miss Hargreaves, he said after a minute or two. I take it that you have no special reason for attaching suspicion more to one person than another? You are only afraid it might prove to be, well, not a servant, shall we say?
That's it exactly, Mr. Blunt. I have honestly no idea who used that piece of brown paper. The handwriting was printed.
There seems only one thing to be done, said Tommy. I must be on the spot.
The girl looked at him inquiringly.
Tommy went on after a moment's thought. I suggest that you prepare the way for the arrival of, say, Mr. and Miss Van Dusen, American friends of yours. Will you be able to do that quite naturally?
Oh, yes. There will be no difficulty at all. When will you come down? Tomorrow or the day after?
Tomorrow, if you please. There is no time to waste.
That is settled, then.
The girl rose and held out her hand. One thing, Miss Hargreaves. Not a word, mind, to anyone, anyone at all, that we are not what we seem.
What do you think of it, Tuppence? He asked when he returned from showing the visitor out.
I don't like it, said Tuppence decidedly. Especially, I don't like the chocolates having so little arsenic in them.
What do you mean?
Well, don't you see? All those chocolates being sent round the neighbourhood were a blind, to establish the idea of a local maniac. Then, when the girl was really poisoned, it would be thought to be the same thing. You see, but for a stroke of luck, no one would ever have guessed that the chocolates were actually sent by someone in the house itself.
That was a stroke of luck, you're right. You think it's a deliberate plot against the girl herself?
I'm afraid so. I remember reading about old Lady Radcliffe's will. That girl has come into a terrific lot of money.
Yes, and she came of age and made a will 3 weeks ago. It looks bad, for Dennis Radcliffe. He gains by her death.
Tuppence nodded. The worst of it is that she thinks so too. That's why she won't have the police called in. Already she suspects him, and she must be more than half in love with him to act as she has done.
In that case, said Tommy thoughtfully, why the devil doesn't he marry her? Much simpler and safer.
Tuppence stared at him. You've said a mouthful, she observed.
Oh, boy. I'm getting ready to be Miss Van Dusen, you observe.
Why rush to crime when there is a lawful means near at hand?
Tuppence reflected for a minute or two.
I've got it, she announced. Clearly, he must have married a barmaid whilst at Oxford. Origin of the quarrel with his aunt. That explains everything.
Well, then why not send the poisoned sweets to the barmaid, suggested Tommy. Much more practical.
I wish you wouldn't jump to these wild conclusions, Tuppence.
They're deductions, said Tuppence, with a good deal of dignity. That is your first corrida, my friend.
But when you have been 20 minutes in the arena... Tommy flung the office cushion at her.
Tuppence, I say. Tuppence, come here.
It was breakfast time the next morning. Tuppence hurried out of her bedroom and into the dining room. Tommy was striding up and down, the open newspaper in his hand.
What's the matter?
Tommy wheeled round and shoved the paper into her hand, pointing to the headlines. Mysterious poisoning case, deaths from fig sandwiches. Tuppence read on. This mysterious outbreak of ptomaine poisoning had occurred at Thurnley Grange. The deaths so far reported were those of Miss Lois Hargreaves, the owner of the house, and the parlourmaid, Esther Quant. A Captain Radcliffe and a Miss Logan were reported to be seriously ill. The cause of the outbreak was supposed to be some fig paste used in sandwiches, since another lady, a Miss Chilcott, who had not partaken of these, was reported to be quite well.
We must get down there at once, said Tommy.
That girl, that perfectly ripping girl, why the devil didn't I go straight down there with her yesterday?
If you had, said Tuppence, you'd probably have eaten fig sandwiches too for tea, and then you'd have been dead. Come on, let's start at once.
I see it says that Dennis Radcliffe is seriously ill also.
Probably shamming the dirty blackguard.
They arrived at the small village of Thurnley about midday. An elderly woman with red eyes opened the door to them when they arrived at Thurnley Grange.
Look here, said Tommy quickly before she could speak. I'm not a reporter or anything like that. Miss Hargreaves came to see me yesterday and asked me to come down here. Is there anyone I can see?
But Dr. Burton is here now, if you'd like to speak to him,
said the woman doubtfully. Or Miss Chilcott? She's making all the arrangements.
But Tommy had caught at the first suggestion.
Dr. Burton, he said authoritatively. I should like to see him at once if he's here.
The woman showed them into a small morning room. 5 minutes later, the door opened, and a tall, elderly man with bent shoulders and a kind but worried face came in.
Dr. Burton, said Tommy. He produced his professional card. Miss Hargreaves called on me yesterday with reference to those poisoned chocolates. I came down to investigate the matter at her request. Alas, too late.
The doctor looked at him keenly.
You are Mr. Blunt himself?
Yes, this is my assistant, Miss Robinson.
The doctor bowed to Tuppence.
Under the circumstances, there is no need for reticence. But for the episode of the chocolates, I might have believed these deaths to be the result of severe ptomaine poisoning. But ptomaine poisoning of an unusually virulent kind. There is gastrointestinal inflammation and hemorrhage. As it is, I am taking the fig paste to be analysed.
You suspect arsenic poisoning?
No. The poison, if a poison has been employed, is something far more potent and swift in its action. It looks more like some powerful vegetable toxin.
I see. I should like to ask you, Dr. Burton, whether you are thoroughly convinced that Captain Radcliffe is suffering from the same form of poisoning.
The doctor looked at him.
Captain Radcliffe is not suffering from any sort of poisoning now.
Aha, said Tommy.
Captain Radcliffe died at 5 o'clock this morning.
Tommy was utterly taken aback. The doctor prepared to depart.
And the other victim? Miss Logan?
Asked Tuppence.
I have every reason to hope that she will recover, since she has survived so far. Being an older woman, the poison seems to have had less effect on her. I will let you know the result of the analysis, Mr. Blundy. In the meantime, Miss Chilcott will, I'm sure, tell you anything you want to know.
As he spoke, the door opened and a girl appeared. She was tall, with a tanned face and steady blue eyes. Dr. Burton performed the necessary introductions.
I'm glad you have come, Mr. Blunt, said Mary Chilcott. This affair seems too terrible. Is there anything you want to know that I can tell you?
Where did the fig paste come from?
It is a special kind that comes from London. We often have it. No one suspected that this particular pot differed from any of the others. Personally, I dislike the flavour of figs. That explains my immunity. I cannot understand how Dennis was affected, since he was out for tea. He must have picked up a sandwich when he came home, I suppose.
Tommy felt Tuppence's hand press his arm ever so slightly. "What time did he come in?" he asked.
"I don't really know. I could find out."
"Thank you, Miss Chilcott, it doesn't matter. You have no objection, I hope, to my questioning the servants."
"Please do anything you like, Mr. Blunt. I'm nearly distraught.
Tell me, you don't think there has been foul play?" Her eyes were very anxious as she put the question. "I don't know what to think. We shall soon know." "Yes, I suppose Dr. Burton will have the paste analysed." Quickly excusing herself, she went out by the window to speak to one of the gardeners. "You take the housemaids, Tuppence," said Tommy, "and I'll find my way to the kitchen." "I say, Miss Chilcott may feel very distraught, but she doesn't look it." Tuppence nodded assent without replying. Husband and wife met half an hour later. "Now, to pool results," said Tommy. "The sandwiches came out for tea, and the parlourmaid ate one. That's how she got it in the neck. Cook is positive Dennis Radcliffe hadn't returned when tea was cleared away. Query, how did he get poisoned?"
"He came in at 7:15, said Tuppence. "Housemaid saw him from one of the windows. He had a cocktail before dinner in the library. She was just clearing away the glass now, and luckily I got it from her before she washed it. It was after that that he complained of feeling ill."
"Good," said Tommy. "I'll take that glass along to Burton presently. Anything else?"
"I'd like you to see Hannah, the maid. She's queer."
"Well, how do you mean, queer?"
"She looks to me as though she were going off her head."
"Let me see her." Tuppence led the way upstairs. Hannah had a small sitting room of her own. The maid sat upright on a high chair. On her knees was an open Bible. She did not look towards the two strangers as they entered. Instead, she continued to read aloud to herself.
"Let hot-burning coals fall upon them. Let them be cast into the fire and into the pit, that they never rise up again."
"May I speak to you a minute?" asked Tommy. Hannah made an impatient gesture with her hand.
"This is no time. The time is running short, I say. I will follow upon mine enemies and overtake them. Neither will I turn again till I have destroyed them. So it is written. The word of the Lord has come to me. I am the scourge of the Lord."
"Mad as a hatter," murmured Tommy.
"She's been going on like that all the time," whispered Tuppence.
Tommy picked up a book that was lying open, face downwards on the table. He glanced at the title and slipped it into his pocket. Suddenly, the old woman rose and turned towards them menacingly.
"Go out from here. The time is at hand. I am the flail of the Lord. The wind bloweth where it listeth. So do I destroy. The ungodly shall perish. This is a house of evil, I tell you. Beware of the wrath of the Lord, whose handmaiden I am."
She advanced upon them fiercely. Tommy thought it best to humour her and withdrew. As he closed the door, he saw her pick up the Bible again.
"I wonder if she's always been like that," he muttered.
He drew from his pocket the book he had picked up off the table. "Look at that. Funny reading for an ignorant maid." Tuppence took the book.
"Materia Medica," she murmured.
She looked at the flyleaf.
"Edward Logan. It's an old book, Tommy. I wonder if we could see Miss Logan. Dr. Burton said she was better."
"Shall we ask Miss Chilcott?"
"No. Let's get hold of a housemaid and send her in to ask."
After a brief delay, they were informed that Miss Logan would see them. They were taken into a big bedroom facing over the lawn. In the bed was an old lady with white hair, her delicate face drawn by suffering.
"I have been very ill," she said faintly, "and I can't talk much. But Ellen tells me you are detectives. Lewis went to consult you then. She spoke of doing so."
"Yes, Miss Logan," said Tommy. "We don't want to tire you, but perhaps you can answer a few questions. The maid, Hannah, is she quite right in her head?" Miss Logan looked at them with obvious surprise.
"Oh, yes. She is very religious, but there's nothing wrong with her."
Tommy held out the book he had taken from the table.
"Is this yours, Miss Logan?"
"Yes. It was one of my father's books. He was a great doctor, one of the pioneers of serum therapeutics."
The old lady's voice rang with pride. "Quite so," said Tommy. "I thought I knew his name," he added mendaciously. "This book now, did you lend it to Hannah?"
"To Hannah?"
Miss Logan raised herself in bed with indignation.
"No, indeed. She wouldn't understand the first word of it. It is a highly technical book."
"Yes, I see that. Yet I found it in Hannah's room."
"Disgraceful," said Miss Logan. "I will not have the servants touching my things."
"Where ought it to be?"
"In the bookshelf, in my sitting room. I lent it to Mary. The dear girl is very interested in herbs. She has made one or two experiments in my little kitchen. I have a little place of my own, you know, where I brew liqueurs and make preserves in the old-fashioned way. Dear Lucy, Lady Radcliffe, you know, used to swear by my tansy tea, a wonderful thing for a cold in the head. Poor Lucy, she was subject to colds. So is Dennis, dear boy. His father was my first cousin."
Tommy interrupted these reminiscences. "This kitchen of yours, does anyone else use it, except you and Miss Chilcott?"
Hannah clears up there, and she boils the kettle there for our early morning tea."
"Thank you, Miss Logan," said Tommy. "There is nothing more I want to ask you at present. I hope we haven't tired you too much." He left the room and went down the stairs, frowning to himself. "There is something here, my dear Mr. Ricardo, that I do not understand."
"I hate this house," said Tuppence with a shiver. "Let's go for a good long walk and try and think things out."
Tommy complied, and they set out. First, they left the cocktail glass at the doctor's house, and then set off for a good tramp across the country, discussing the case as they did so. "It makes it easier, somehow, if one plays the fool," said Tommy. "All this Hanno business. I suppose some people would think I didn't care, but I do, most awfully. I feel that somehow or other we ought to have prevented this."
"I think that's foolish of you," said Tuppence.
"It's not as though we advised Lois Hargreaves not to go to Scotland Yard or anything like that. Nothing would have induced her to bring the police into the matter. If she hadn't come to us, she would have done nothing at all." "And the result would have been the same. Yes, you're right, Tuppence. It's morbid to reproach oneself over something one couldn't help. What I would like to do is to make good now. And that's not going to be easy." "No, it isn't. There are so many possibilities, and yet all of them seem wild and improbable. Supposing Dennis Radcliffe put the poison in the sandwiches? He knew he would be out to tea. That seems fairly plain sailing."
"Yes," said Tuppence. "That's all right so far. Then we could put against that the fact that he was poisoned himself. So that seems to rule him out.
There is one person we mustn't forget, and that is Hannah."
"Hannah?
People do all sorts of queer things when they have religious mania." "She is pretty far gone with it, too," said Tommy. "You ought to drop a word to Dr. Burton about it."
"It must have come on very rapidly," said Tuppence.
"That is, if we go by what Miss Logan said."
"Well, I believe religious mania does," said Tommy. "I mean, you go on singing hymns in your bedroom with the door open for years, then you go suddenly right over the line and become violent."
"There is certainly more evidence against Hannah than against anybody else," said Tuppence thoughtfully.
"And yet, I have an idea."
She stopped.
"Yes," said Tommy encouragingly. "It's not really an idea. I suppose it's just a prejudice."
"A prejudice against someone?"
Tuppence nodded. "Tommy, did you like Mary Chilcott?"
Tommy considered.
"Well, yes, I think I did. She struck me as extremely capable and businesslike. Perhaps a shade too much so, but very reliable."
"You didn't think it was odd that she didn't seem more upset?"
"Well, in a way, that is a point in her favour. I mean, if she had done anything, she would make a point of being upset, lay it on rather thick."
"I suppose so," said Tuppence. "And anyway, there doesn't seem to be any motive in her case. One doesn't see what good this wholesale slaughter can do her."
"I suppose none of the servants are concerned."
"It doesn't seem likely. They seem a quiet, reliable lot. I wonder what Esther Quant, the parlourmaid, was like."
"Well, you mean that if she was young and good-looking, there was a chance that she was mixed up in it some way?"
"That is what I mean," Tuppence sighed.
"It is all very discouraging.
Well, I suppose the police will get down to it all right, said Tommy.
Probably. I should like it to be us. By the way, did you notice a lot of small red dots on Miss Logan's arm?
I don't think I did. What about them?
They looked as though they were made by a hypodermic syringe, said Tuppence.
Probably Dr. Burton gave her a hypodermic injection of some kind.
Oh, very likely. But he wouldn't give her about 40.
The cocaine habit? Suggested Tommy helpfully.
I thought of that, said Tuppence.
But her eyes were all right. You could see at once if it was cocaine or morphia. Besides, she doesn't look that sort of old lady.
Most respectable and God-fearing, agreed Tommy.
It is all very difficult, said Tuppence.
We have talked and talked, and we don't seem any nearer now than we were. Don't let's forget to call at the doctor's on our way home.
The doctor's door was opened by a lanky boy of about 15.
Mr. Blunt? He inquired.
Yes, the doctor is out, but he left a note for you, in case you should call.
He handed them the note in question, and Tommy tore it open.
Dear Mr. Blunt, there is reason to believe that the poison employed was ricin, a vegetable toxalbumose of tremendous potency. Please keep this to yourself for the present.
Tommy let the note drop, but picked it up quickly.
Ricin, he murmured.
Know anything about it, Tuppence?
You used to be rather well up in these things.
Ricin, said Tuppence thoughtfully. You get it out of castor oil, I believe.
I never did take kindly to castor oil, said Tommy. I'm more set against it than ever now.
The oil's all right. You get ricin from the seeds of the castor oil plant.
I believe I saw some castor oil plants in the garden this morning. Big things with glossy leaves.
You mean that someone extracted the stuff on the premises?
Could Hannah do such a thing?
Tuppence shook her head.
Doesn't seem likely. She wouldn't know enough.
Suddenly, Tommy gave an exclamation.
That book! Have I got it in my pocket still?
Yes.
He took it out and turned over the leaves vehemently.
I thought so. Here's the page it was open at this morning. Do you see, Tuppence? Ricin!
Tuppence seized the book from him.
Can you make head or tail of it? I can't.
Well, it's clear enough to me, said Tuppence.
She walked along reading busily with one hand on Tommy's arm to steer herself. Presently she shut the book with a bang. They were just approaching the house again.
Tommy, will you leave this to me, just for once? You see, I am the bull that has been more than 20 minutes in the arena.
Tommy nodded.
You shall be captain of the ship, Tuppence, he said gravely. We've got to get to the bottom of this.
First of all, said Tuppence, as they entered the house, I must ask Miss Logan one more question.
She ran upstairs. Tommy followed her. She rapped sharply on the old lady's door and went in.
Is that you, my dear? Said Miss Logan. You know, you are much too young and pretty to be a detective. Have you found out anything?
Yes, said Tuppence, I have.
Miss Logan looked at her questioningly.
I don't know about being pretty, went on Tuppence, but being young, I happened to work in a hospital during the war. I know something about serum therapeutics. I happen to know that when ricin is injected in small doses hypodermically, immunity is produced and anti-ricin is formed. That fact paved the way for the foundation of serum therapeutics.
You knew that, Miss Logan.
You injected ricin for some time hypodermically into yourself. Then you let yourself be poisoned with the rest. You helped your father in his work, and you knew all about ricin and how to obtain it and extract it from the seeds. You chose a day when Dennis Radcliffe was out for tea. It wouldn't do for him to be poisoned at the same time. He might die before Lois Hargreaves. So long as she died first, he inherited her money, and at his death it passes to you, his next of kin. You remember? You told us this morning that his father was your first cousin.
The old lady stared at Tuppence with baleful eyes. Suddenly, a wild figure burst in from the adjoining room. It was Hannah. In her hand she held a lighted torch, which she waved frantically.
"Truth has been spoken. That is the wicked one. I saw her reading the book and smiling to herself, and I knew. I found the book and the page, but it said nothing to me, but the voice of the Lord spoke to me. She hated my mistress, her ladyship. She was always jealous and envious. She hated my own sweet Miss Lois. But the wicked shall perish. The fire of the Lord shall consume them."
Waving her torch, she sprang forward to the bed. A cry arose from the old lady.
Take her away! Take her away! It's true! But take her away!
Tuppence flung herself upon Hannah, but the woman managed to set fire to the curtains of the bed before Tuppence could get the torch from her and stamp on it. Tommy, however, had rushed in from the landing outside. He tore down the bed hangings and managed to stifle the flames with a rug. Then he rushed to Tuppence's assistance, and between them they subdued Hannah just as Dr. Burton came hurrying in. A very few words sufficed to put him au courant of the situation. He hurried to the bedside, lifted Miss Logan's hand, then uttered a sharp exclamation.
"The shock of fire has been too much for her. She's dead. Perhaps it is as well under the circumstances."
He paused, and then added,
"There was ricin in the cocktail glass as well."
"It's the best thing that could have happened," said Tommy, when they had relinquished Hannah to the doctor's care and were alone together. "Tuppence, you were simply marvellous."
"There wasn't much Hanno about it," said Tuppence.
"It was too serious for play-acting. I still can't bear to think of that girl. I won't think of her. But as I said before, you were marvellous. The honours are with you. To use a familiar quotation, it is a great advantage to be intelligent and not to look it."
"Tommy," said Tuppence, "you're a beast."